Good morning, how are you?
I'm not too
Hi.
Bad. How are
hey,
you?
You're here. How are you?
It's just a little after 8:30, and I'd like to call this retreat to order. Is that possible? Yes, that's possible. I'd like to call the first ever Mental Health Board retreat to order. Stephanie, would you please call the roll?
Astrid Berkson, Island Anavy, Susan Fowler,
here.
Dolores Henry,
here.
Tom Moore,
here.
Judy O'Connor,
here.
Julian Rappaport,
here.
Ann Robin,
here.
Deborah Townsend,
here.
Retreats are wild and open, right? Let's be thankful that Peter is here.
That's right, yes. Okay, I'm not sure who to turn the meeting over to. The evaluation team, I guess. So I'm doing that right now and turning off.
All right.
Nicole.
Yeah. Good morning, Deb.
Good morning.
Did you want to say anything, Mark, before we go?
Sure. As you know, last April or so, the question, or actually it's come up a number of times, but last April I think there were some very clear direction from the board about wanting to pursue some evaluation of the, I guess, the agency's capacity as well as what the Mental Health Board is requiring of agencies. And so we contracted with Nicole Allen and Mark Aber from the University of Illinois Department of Psychology. They have some experience working with the agencies that, as well as the Mental Health Board. And over the last several months, we've had some, I guess, organizational type meetings with a committee comprised of staff, the evaluation team, as well as board representatives, and have moved forward to the point where they have presented an overview to all of our, at the Mental Health Agency Council meetings, an overview of what this project involves and some of the expectations. And then I have done an orientation with them and shared a number of materials with them in terms of what the board, the Mental Health Board requires of agencies, as well as the reporting processes and so forth. And they have identified a group of agencies with whom they plan to do a little more intensive work in their evaluation. And I think from here, we're gonna hear a little bit about evaluation, what it entails, and then where they're headed. And I think with that, I'll leave it to Mark and Nicole.
Thanks, Mark. Good morning, everyone. We're very happy to be here with all of you. And we were asked to think about or doing a brief introduction of evaluation, so that's how we want to start. In part because there's a lot of different language used in evaluation, we're not going to go through it all, but if we think about this as a first step to identifying some common language or the kinds of things that we might talk about or think about when we think about evaluation, we want to do a bit there. We also want to do a brief overview of the proposal. I know that you have all seen it, but we thought we would just highlight some of its component parts, and then also highlight what do we mean by evaluation capacity in particular as it relates to that proposal, and discuss the primary thing we want to spend time on is discussing your evaluation needs and priorities. So I want to go through this relatively quickly, although I would say feel free to interrupt, especially with clarifying questions. So. But we really want to use the bulk of the time in discussion, because evaluation always starts with what it is that you want and need to know, and then of course capacity gets built around that. And we also had a first meeting with providers, that small group that Mark mentioned. We've had our kickoff meeting with that small group of providers as well, funded agencies. And so this is another part of understanding what it is that you're hoping for. And Mark, what is our total? What total time? Where do you want to make sure we're?
I think an hour to an hour and a half.
Okay, great. All right, so that's our emphasis. And I realize that the slides that I've made are behind you, Julian and Dolores. Oh, they're there too? Okay, good, good. I was going to say. Okay. So what is evaluation? You know, the simplest way to think about evaluation is that it's really just asking questions, right? It's asking questions and then trying to answer those questions with some kind of systematic inquiry. So we're analyzing, we're reflecting, and then we're making judgments about whatever evidence we gather. And then ideally, we're doing something in response to learning something new in that evaluation process. And we can think about evaluation in terms of formative evaluation, or what's sometimes referred to as process evaluation. And if you think about the word formative, thinks about our formative years of development, and that's exactly what it refers to. As something is developing, as something's being implemented, there's lots of questions that we can ask about how that's happening, how it's working, how well it's working, for whom, and I'll go into a couple of examples around this as we go forward. And then there's also another type of evaluation that's sometimes referred to as summative or outcome evaluation. And these are two big umbrellas, but that summative or outcome evaluation has to do with the judgments we're making about the effects that something has or the worth that it has. So if you think about the word summative, it's like summary judgment, right? That's what summative evaluation refers to. The thing about evaluation is when you think about formative and summative evaluation, just about everything we do, from the moment we begin to develop a service to the moment we are implementing an evidence-based practice to trying to understand how it's experienced by those we're serving, there are many, many different sorts of questions that we can ask. So evaluation is not just about how well did this work. That's actually only one narrow way to think about evaluation as it relates to outcomes. So we really want to be thinking about that full gamut of the sorts of questions that you all could be asking. And I would also encourage when we get to the discussion part, you don't have to have some kind of fully formed research question. Just put out, like, you know what I wonder about? I've always wanted to know. That's usually where evaluation questions start, actually, with those sorts of musings. So you don't have to be coming up with a fully formed question with a method attached. Just sharing, like, what are your questions? What do you wish you knew that you don't know? I'm not promising that we can build capacity to answer those, but it's good to know what you're wondering about as that starting place. The last bit of language I want to introduce here is fidelity. So fidelity, you hear this a lot actually right now, an emphasis on fidelity. And that's because we're in an era of evidence-based practice. So lots of people are saying, lots of funders across the country and federal funders are saying, we want you to implement evidence-based practices. Evidence-based practices are practices where there has been some systematic research done, often with a controlled trial, which is a particular type of method where some people get the service and some don't. There's a true random control. And those who got the service do better than those who didn't. And there's some evidence base that says, yes, this is an effective way to intervene with a particular group. When you're implementing an evidence-based practice, people often ask questions about fidelity, which is, did we do it in the way the people who created this intervention said we should in order to get the kinds of outcomes that we should expect to see? So, right, we're doing the same thing that this entity did that said, hey, this is an evidence-based practice. We can take wraparound as an example. So we know there's a huge evidence base to say that wraparound with families that have complex needs is an effective approach to intervention. But often with wraparound approaches, they say when they're not implemented with high fidelity to the principles of wraparound, you won't see the same effects. So for example, did the youth have a voice in the process? Was it truly family guided? Were there truly a complex array of providers present? Were all those things in place? And looking at how much those things were in place, that's fidelity. So that's just another evaluation term. And I really do want you to encourage, you know, I want to encourage you to just jump in if you want me to further explain something or, because I know there's a varied amount of experience, which is totally fine. We want to get everyone on the same page with language. Okay. Go ahead, Pete.
I was just going to remind everybody that with PLL, the Parenting with Love and Limits program, that's one of the things that we pay for is the fidelity oversight from the creators of the method.
And yeah, and that's very common with evidence-based practice. So I always like to put this up because, you know, we're always evaluating. Do you like that, like, butternut squash soup? I was very, it felt very full to me. But we're always evaluating. So evaluation, in some ways, really is like second nature to us. We often are making judgments about things based on observations we have made about them. So we use a food example here. How well did that recipe work? We might ask an analogous question. What would make our services better, right? And when we're thinking about how well a recipe worked, we can do that with our service delivery process as well. We put these things together to serve this population. How did that go? How closely was the recipe followed? That's a fidelity example, right? It said, like, don't add too much clove, but then I got really carried away, and it was too much, right? And so this is fidelity to the recipe, fidelity to the program model. And the thing about fidelity is when you do a local adaptation, usually you need to make adjustments. You need to make adjustments. These programs can't just be, like, plopped down in a community. They won't be as effective. At the same time, you have to ask fidelity questions to ask, okay, we're messing with this a little bit. How much leeway is there in this recipe? And we still get, like, delicious soup on the back end, or we still get the sorts of outcomes we're hoping to see with families. What did the people who cooked, ate, or paid for the meal think, right? So how was it received by others in that process? How did they experience it? And we ask the same sorts of questions in the service delivery arena. How did the people receiving a service experience that service? And then how well did the meal nourish those who ate it? So what outcomes or changes resulted for those served? And found this fun quote from Robert Stake, who is an evaluation scholar at University of Illinois, and I just thought this was too perfect given the picture. When the cook tastes the soup, that's formative. When the guests taste the soup, that's summative, right? So when we're still making the soup and tasting the soup and asking questions about how's this soup coming, that's formative. But when someone's actually consuming it now, all those other questions come into play that kind of move along that continuum to the summative end of that. Any questions at all so far? Okay. So it's a systematic gathering to answer questions. And this is where it moves a little bit away from our day-to-day practice, because we do make a lot of evaluations and judgments in our day-to-day. And in fact, we often sort of have feelings about something like, I don't think that works, or I feel like we're doing a great job, because often you'll hear providers have that sort of experience where they feel like we are observing things where we know that families are receiving something's happening that's positive for families. And we want to move an evaluation from that anecdotal, observation, less systematic space to one where you're doing it in a systematic enough way that you can feel like, yeah, my observations are being made in a way that I can draw some conclusions, usually not absolutely definitive conclusions. And I think this is an important thing to say again and again. Very little of what we can structure with limited resources tells us definitively something works, something doesn't work. It usually calls for particular sorts of methods, but we can ask lots of questions about how things work, why they work, when they work better than others, with whom they work better than others, right? So there's lots of questions. So summative, to what extent do services meet clients' needs? How do clients change over time as a result of services? Formative questions, how are services working to meet client needs? So for example, we can ask questions about how accessible the service is, who receives it, who doesn't, who was the target population, were they reached, right? Those are formative questions about how we engage in the front end of that service process. Who do we engage better than others? Who do we fail to engage when we get referrals? Who actually comes through our door? And who do we get referrals for but they don't come through our door? These are all subject to evaluation questions if they're of interest to you. I'm not prescribing these. I'm saying, like, you can run the gamut from the very beginning. Who stays in our services? Questions about attrition are often incredibly important. You get to the back end of a service process, you got 10 people left in it, you started with 30, you lost 20. There's always going to be some natural attrition, but is there a pattern? Did you lose a particular population within those you started serving? Who were the 10 that stayed? Did they have particular supports in place that made them more likely to be able to get through the full service process and others didn't, right? So these are just all examples of the kind of process questions that can be asked. Are we doing what we think we're doing? I mean, this is a very important question, just generally speaking, because we have plans and then we have actions, and usually there's some distance between the two, and that's just natural. but something you can look at systematically. And ideally, evaluation is a way to guide action. And I often think of evaluation, and of course I'd have this bias as a researcher, but we've often talked about this as evaluation as a part of ethical practice, because they really just go together. I'm doing, and I'm looking at what I'm doing and understanding it, and I'm doing, I'm looking, and I'm making adjustments. And it really is actually a part of practice, not something totally separate from it. So I asked my sixth grader, what do you see in this picture? So what do you all see? Anyone willing to chime in? I'm gonna shut my mic for a second. So I asked my sixth grader, and he said, well, he said, I think that's Santa, and I think the reindeer in the chair is very nervous. I said, I think you're right. I put this up because it's just kind of a perfect little cartoon for often what evaluation actually invokes, in that it's hard to be evaluated. It feels like, you know, here I guess there's a performance evaluation going on, but it can absolutely feel that way when evaluation is framed as high stakes, when evaluation is framed more in terms of, you know, with a stick that says, if this doesn't go a particular way, there'll be some kind of a loss. And of course, we want a balance because we want accountability, and evaluation is a part of accountability. But if we create a really accountability-focused culture, then evaluation becomes mostly about compliance, and it can actually really come into conflict with learning. So when you think about building evaluation capacity, and I'll get to this in just a couple moments, you also want to build an evaluation culture that emphasizes learning organizations. You know, ideally, because otherwise, what you'll get is what people think you want. So if you really want, you know, a process where people are looking at what really worked, what didn't, what needed to be tweaked, what was successful, where did we fail, there needs to be a culture that says that level of exploration will be okay, and actually it will help make us a stronger service system, period, or at least for those funded agencies of the Mental Health Board. So we want to avoid evaluation really be an extension of blaming. And I'm not saying anybody's doing this, by the way. We just really want to share this as a way, the way we'd think about and frame this sort of process. So we want to encourage deep understanding. We want to be learning organizations. We want accountability for action with opportunities to improve. So both of those sitting side by side. And we want to encourage transparent sharing. So just to pause there for a moment about a little bit of that kind of 101 about how we think about evaluation and some evaluation terminology. Are there any questions or comments? Go ahead, Tom. Yeah, I think that it's a structural problem, right? Because anyone, in any kind of funding-fundee relationship, there's going to be a power differential that's kind of built in there. So it's, I don't mean to say like, oh, we can snap our fingers, it'll go away, because it's built into the structure. And I actually think funders ought to be able to ask questions about like accountability, did what we thought would happen, and so on. I think the answer, Tom, probably comes through a collaborative process in the sense that the degree to which this is structured in a way that is participatory, where, you know, all of the relevant stakeholders, the board and people invested in evaluation on the board and providers who are invested in evaluation, and there are many who are really invested in evaluation, very insightful about the process. Our meeting with the providers was great in terms of the things that they think about. And so I think if you build in a collaborative process and then you articulate expectations, I think that needs to be a part of the plan that we want to work toward around building capacity, so that, that it has that feeling of a learning organization, and also that the expectations are clear. So this idea that we might target or begin with a few organizations, making expectations clear about what are the consequences. Let's say we find out that there is that this doesn't work at all. What happens as a result of that? So I think it's important to have those sort of conversations up front in anticipation of those sorts of outcomes, because, you know, it can be very high stakes. So I think it's like putting it on the table and working in a participatory way. Mark, did you want to answer? Go ahead, Tom.
I would agree with what Nicole said, and I would just add that I think inviting organizations to articulate what it is they want to know and helping them learn about what their question, the answer to the questions they have about their own organization so that they can do what they do better is one way to help build a culture of learning and an one that's warm to evaluation. And I also think that it, we're basically talking about a pretty complex organization, one that starts with you all, as possibly as with the community, as stakeholders in the mental health of our community, and then you as gatekeepers for how we distribute some funds to do that, and then a set of organizations, agencies that are trying to do that work. And I think it's creating a openness and a value for evaluation at the top of the organization helps. So I think how you think about and communicate to agencies in our community about the value of evaluation helps to build a positive culture for that. And then I think providing the supports that organizations need to be able to answer the questions they want to answer. So what be it technical assistance, knowledge, resources, those kinds of things. And we're going to talk a lot about building evaluation capacity.
Hi, Susan Fowler. I'm sure you'll get to this, but I just want to ensure that it is on the agenda, and that is, I know that several of the agencies belong to organizations that require annual or every other year evaluations that are fairly extensive. And so how do we take advantage of already existing evaluations without adding further burden? I was interested in reading about Parenting with Love and Limits. There are evaluations that have been completed on the outcomes that when I asked, I was able to get, but I hadn't known about them before. So how do we bring together what already exists before we create another layer of requirements on our organizations?
And I actually think we should absolutely, the plan should not be layered on another set of requirements, for sure. And that's something that we talked about with the providers. So they all have existing mandates around data gathering of some sort or another. And some of those mandates actually result in feedback that comes to the organization, but actually some don't. So sometimes they have data gathering mandates, and the data goes out, but it doesn't come back to them in the form of how well did you do with your clients? What happened? Who was served? Who did you retain? Who didn't you retain? So they also engage in some data gathering that doesn't actually close the loop on learning. So there might even be existing data sources where we could think about the capacity building being closing the loop on learning. Use the data they're already gathering, but use it locally as opposed to just the repository at the level of the state, for example, or at the level of another entity. And part of the challenge is, of course, you have 27 funded programs. They all have different mandates attached to them. So I think, and that's a part of what we want to be doing with providers and a part of the plan to understand what is that range of mandates that they have. What sorts of data are they already gathering? How is that built in? How might it help or dovetail with what CCMHB does? And, in a dream, you might say, how do local funders coordinate across in terms of what they require? But recognize that might be very much, much more easily accomplished in a fantasy than in reality. But, yeah, go ahead, Pete.
To what extent, another factor that I'm sure every provider in the room and we're all aware of, and you're aware of at the university, is the state of Illinois situation and the fact that many agencies are in serious trouble right now. And I guess one of the concerns I have at this point, and I know that we don't necessarily fund the exact same things that the state funds because primarily Medicaid is the primary funder, but you know, I think that we have to be cognizant of that as part of this process, and I just want to get your thoughts on that and how that plays into it. That doesn't mean we abdicate our responsibility, but we have to be aware of it. I think basically my point is that people are in a survival mode right now. So, to some degree, you know, when I talk to folks, they're so focused on whether their doors are going to be open, and the staff that they're losing, or the staff that they can't retain, that thinking about, you know, it's sort of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, it's like, if you don't have food, how can you be thinking about art? You know, and I think that to some degree we're at that stage, and you know, and I think that there's maybe a tendency to think that as a local funder, that we are sort of like a charity as opposed to a purchaser of services. And so, you know, I guess one possible response could be that people would think, why don't you just give us the money to help us survive at this point, as opposed to purchasing services for which there is accountability. And, you know, and I that's, you know, there we have to strike a balance there, I think.
And I don't know that I have any particular comment regarding that, except that if I think about it from an evaluation standpoint, when you're then using precious limited resources, you can pose questions that help you think about to maximize the use of precious limited resources. So, I mean, I think it's a hard question in the ask in the abstract, and I think it would have to be asked in the particular. Yeah. Julian, were you?
So, I'm just trying to assimilate what's been said so far, and I wrote a little note to myself in which what seems important to me is for us to ask questions, and this would encompass both what organizations are already collecting and what I think what Susan referred to as kind of the, they have a burden. So it's interesting to me to think about it, and I know a lot of organizations do think about the information they're forced to collect as a burden. So I guess what I'm wondering is if there's not a way we can start to, at the point of, before we begin it, or at the point where the data is collected, it would be nice to know in advance or have some ideas about how is this information going to be used. So for example, if all it is that you collect it because it's a requirement and it goes away and you never hear anything else about it, well, that is a burden. It's just a waste of your time. It satisfies somebody else's need, not yours. It may be necessary for certain, you know, financial reporting or things like that to assure for accountability. But I would resent doing evaluation if I didn't know how the information were going to be used. And I think, so I want to loop back onto other things being said here, that I think the only reason for doing evaluation is because you want to get better at what you do. And there's where I think we have a difficult time. Everybody hates change. Nobody wants to do anything different than they're already doing because it's hard. And everybody who thinks they know what they're doing because they don't want to look closely at it. I'm not talking about anybody in particular. I'm talking about us too. We have a system that we've been operating on, and you know, we don't necessarily want to change it, even though we sometimes say we do. So I think the idea that when we're talking about evaluation, we're also expecting that the information will be used and asking people to adopt an attitude of self-imposed change for improvement. Now, how we facilitate that seems to me just an important part of everything you're saying, so.
Ann, you had a question, and then Tom, I want to, if it's related to this clarifying, and then I want to just make sure everyone's on the page, because we're starting to talk a little bit about the substance, and I want to make sure everyone is understanding, like, when we say evaluation capacity, like, what are we talking about? Mark started talking about it, and do that, and then come back to some of the substance. But go ahead, Ann.
Well, it's just sort of some ideas that came to me in light of what Peter said. And I'm a relatively new member of the board, so I'm still trying to figure out, you know, exactly how this process works. But it seems to me that there are two distinct kinds of evaluation that I need as a board member in order to make the decision about funding, which is, I think, our mandate. And the first one is, I think what you're talking about is how well is the agency working, the self-evaluation of the agency and our understanding of that. How are they providing the services? Is there fidelity and what are the outcomes? So is it a good organization and is it providing good services? And in light of what Peter is saying, a lot of agencies are really in survivor mode right now because they are trying desperately to provide the services that they already have evaluated and are ongoing evaluating. But then the second part, which I have more trouble with, is also from what you said, Peter, that we're purchasing services. We're not a charity. It's not just, well, this is a great organization. You know, I love developmental services. They do a great job. You know, I always want to support them. I'm picking on them because they're my organization and I do love them and I do always want to support them. But, you know, that would be sort of as a charity. The question is harder for me to get at is how much difference to that organization will this $500,000 that we can give them make? And is that really, you know, advancing their cause and what kind of services are coming out of that? And I think that's the tricky one that the board has a hard time with. We can say, yes, this is a good organization. We like what they're doing. Their evaluations are adequate. They've got lots of good things going on. But how much difference is this $500,000 going to make to them? That's the part that I have trouble understanding. Does that resonate with some people?
I think that's a really important question. I mean, that will get to the kinds of questions that you would hope to have answers to. And that's one, that is, I mean, it's a tough one. Just to clarify, Ann, is it also, are you wondering in the absence of those services, I mean, in the absence of that money, would they carry on without it? Or are you, because I'm wondering, I'm trying to understand the comment too in light of like, is it because you're thinking about maximizing local disbursement and maybe there's some funds that could be pulled from an organization and that organization carries on and other local needs that could be met more strategically that are not otherwise met?
Yeah, I think those are the kind of questions that I'm talking about. And in some cases, you know, the life of the organization might depend on the grant. And in other cases, it would be a service that they wouldn't have been able to offer otherwise would be what we would make possible. How do you make those decisions?
You know, it would seem to me that we're doing this informally, right? I don't want to, if I'm speaking out of
turn. You don't have to raise your
okay?
hand.
Yeah. It would seem to me that that question, which I resonate to, I really like the way you put that. It's very helpful to me to think about what you just said. It immediately made me think that that's also interacts with a question of what are our priorities? I mean, we would have a hard time answering that question in the abstract or only determined by external matters. I think that forces us to say, what are our priorities? Because then we have something to test that added value against. So that's all made me think of that.
I had a thought about Julian's other question, which I had completely forgotten what it was.
I have an excuse, Tom.
But
Julian.
But part of what does come back to me, now I've even lost that. Oh, the idea both you and Mark mentioned in terms of creating this attitude about evaluation, which sounds, makes sense to me, the idea of collaboration. So it's not done in a vacuum in the absence of the agencies that we're working with, but it sounds like your plans are, and have been, to work directly with them. So that, so some of those questions that might be asked in that way are, can be presented in that, from that grouping, the way you organize it. That seems like that gets to the heart of this, creating the culture of evaluation, that they're involved in it. It doesn't just land on them. They can participate in it. So the sense that they may feel imposed on, maybe it'll go away, maybe it won't, but at least you're approaching it in a way that it can be addressed way before your actual implementation of the evaluation process.
Yeah, and I think that it's got, you know, at least two components, because there's the structural things we can think about. So how do we structure a process to try to, you know, and then there's the attitudinal pieces. But when you think about a change process, people feel more ownership of a change when they're involved in it. And that's not a manipulation. It's just a natural thing. If somebody says, do this, go do this, you know, it's like, well, who are you telling me go do this, you know? But if it's really more like, what are we going to do when we plan together, it just naturally creates ownership. So it's just a good principle of organizational change, which is actually, this is kind of an organizational change strategy. And it's not just about providers. It's about the board itself, right? So really, it's all of those layers. So I think the more that there's ownership created, the better off we'll be. And also the product will be better, right? That more and more research now that says more voices, more perspectives, better decision making. It's just something that we can point to now that's in an evidence-based practice in terms of how to go about these kinds of things. Pete, did you want to jump in, and then Dolores, and then I want to just go through some of the capacity stuff, and then we're going to just cycle right back to discussion and stay there. Yeah.
Actually, Julian said exactly what I was going to say in response to Anne, and that was the importance of developing the priorities, and that's basically all I wanted to say.
Well, my difficulty always when we allocate the funds is to try and decide if the agencies came up with plans that matched our 3-year objectives. And oftentimes they don't seem to be in sync with what we said we wanted. But I like to think that we're on automatic pilot, so we just go ahead and fund, even though some of the agencies didn't come up to where we thought the change should come. So how do we get at that in the evaluation process?
Well, you all are asking awesome questions. And this is exactly what we want to come away with, which is a clear understanding of, you know, what is it that the Mental Health Board is hoping for as it relates to this process. So as you know, the aim of the effort is to build evaluation capacity. And I wanted to take a few moments just to define that so that, again, like in the spirit of shared language, that we're all thinking and talking about the same thing. So the capacity refers to the ability or power to do, experience, or understand something. And we're taking that concept and relating it to evaluation in particular. So in organizations, we talk about organizational capacity a lot, so efforts to strengthen operations, right? And that could have to do with management or technology, communications, advocacy, leadership, and development. And evaluation capacity refers to the specific process of improving an organization's ability to use evaluation to learn from its work. To go back to what Julian said, like, hey, if we don't have something to learn, this is not about our learning, like, let's not do evaluation. Evaluation capacity, it ought to be tied to that they have the capacity and ability to evaluate, to learn from their work and improve their results. And building capacity can and often includes building knowledge and skills. And also, we can provide these slides if everybody wants them. Building knowledge and skills. Because people need to know what to do. Like, is this a measure worth using? Why would I use this one versus another one? I mean, there's just basic knowledge around how to structure that evaluation. And then a skill set to implement. So that's fairly obvious, but then we want to do that. Build buy-in and evaluation culture, which we've been talking about. And then building the necessary resources. Because we also don't want to create not just piling on to what people also have to do, but then other unfunded mandates where it's like they have to just figure out again in a time of resource scarcity, how are we going to do this additional stuff with no resources? So we have to think about it. And we also have to think about resources as they relate to what's really possible. I mean, we want to create and think about building evaluation capacity with the realities of the current climate in terms of fiscal climate and in terms of the local service array in mind. So we want to create something that's very grounded in that context. And I found this clip art here because the last point here is building supportive networks. And a lot of times when people approach building evaluation capacity, they build in things like peer learning. So when you talk about how do you create a culture, well, sometimes you also build in, oh, what did you all learn? Oh, we learned this, you know? Help us think about what kind of adjustments to make. Those things don't really happen in isolation. The other thing is if you want to guard against being in deep ruts where you always do the same thing over and over again, invite people to look at what you do. Because they'll be like, you know, you've been on that stationary cycle for a really long time. They will see things you don't see. So peer learning structures, collaborative structures like that are really helpful. People often build capacity through coaching and training, which gets to the knowledge and skills pieces. By, you know, having experienced consultants who can sit down with a particular agency and say, what are you currently doing? How can we push it forward in light of best practices? And then thinking about existing tools and resources. And then the technology piece is no small thing, because sometimes agencies don't even have a computer that they can dedicate to entering data or making it electronic. In one of the statewide efforts I was a part of, we were trying to help, at the time, Illinois Violence Prevention Authority, who's now with the Illinois Justice Criminal Justice Information Authority, so they have a little more support. They funded a program, and they wanted to kind of bring it into a single space, so they sent us stuff from all over the state. And some of the folks were processing stuff like with tick marks, you know, where you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know. And so we got paper where they added everything up just by hand, and we got sheets where they were just doing math and then counting and recounting to check. And that's, I don't know that we have anybody doing that exactly here, but the technology pieces are a huge part of capacity. And I'm not going to talk about this in any great depth, but as anywhere there's a concept, there's a bunch of academics who are trying to understand what is the heart of this concept. And this is a model of evaluation capacity building, and it actually has a lot of really intuitive, I think, invaluable elements to guide our work. So we won't walk through it here, but these are the sorts of things we're going to be wanting to think about as we plan. And I will share this, and I can share the paper that it goes with if you want. So we want to build capacity as it reflects local priorities and realities. We want to understand what you want to know and then think about how to build a process. Does this mean we're going to be able to create a plan for you where there's a plan to fund all 27 funded agencies? Probably not. There'll be some pieces that are generalizable, hopefully, that are about building capacity broadly, and maybe some pieces that start with particular organizations to build capacity. But that's what we want to work toward, that kind of understanding. I'm not going to talk about these deliverables here because you have them, but we have articulated the products that we want to work toward by the end of the fiscal year, and we'll certainly adjust if we can do anything in real time even more quickly, we'll do it. As Mark said, we have already met with providers, we met with MHC, we met with a subset of providers, we have another provider meeting scheduled in a few weeks. We met with a subcommittee of the board. We are now meeting with all of you. So we're really in an information gathering mode. The other thing that we've done, and by we, I mean our RA executed this. Hope Holland is the student who's working on this project. She couldn't be here because of class. But she has already made a pass at extracting information from all of your 2015 performance outcome applications and performance outcome reports for all 27 funded agencies. So we're also going to come back to you with summary saying, here's a snapshot of what your agencies are currently doing. Here's what we know about how they're gathering the data, what they're gathering, on what outcomes, so we can give that back to you as a snapshot. So that's, we've taken a pass at 2015. We want to do at least 2014, possibly 2013. If there's not difference going back in years, and then provide that back as a snapshot. So those are the things that are ongoing, and now we're with all of you. So. We want to just let the discussion go ahead again and, you know, all of your great insights and thoughts about what you're hoping for. I'm going to turn it over to Mark to facilitate you all contributing to that discussion, and I'm going to note take, chime in here and there.
Yeah.
Just talk.
Okay, conversation.
So one of the things, as I have now been on the board for 2 years, that I reflect on, that in the first year, when I read every online application, I was overwhelmed. In the second year, I read the summaries, and I was not quite as overwhelmed because I had more context. Now it'll be my third year, and we'll be making priorities known to the agencies. They'll be responding, and sometime in April and May, we'll be making decisions. I looked at the timeline, and Peter, a few months ago, provided the usual timeline that this board follows for the content of its meetings from basically July to June. And what I'm missing is where we build into our meetings time to consider evaluation and time to actually reflect on, as you said, 2013, 2014, 2015. What does our funding pattern look like over a five-year time period? And are we getting what we want over that five-year time period, even if the data are from 1 year or 2 year as we begin to collect that evaluation data? But there is no time aside from today with this wonderful retreat for us to consider the results and the outcomes. So we're in a pattern of kind of announcing priorities, putting out requests for proposals, getting the proposals, having staff summarize them, bringing them to the board making decisions, et cetera. And I'd like us to be able in this evaluation process to stop, not stop our work, but to have built into our schedule some opportunities to really think through with the agencies what their outcomes are and what their priorities are. Because it does seem like right now we're on pilot. Not a bad pilot, but that we have a routine that we follow. And so if in fact we want to create some new initiatives or we have some new priorities, how do we evaluate where we take a limited pool of funds and shift some of those priorities, unless we have unlimited funds. So I don't want to make the assumption that it is limited. So
when you're talking about we, do you mean
I'm talking about what the staff brings to the board for board discussion.
So you want a space there for the staff to be able to evaluate the evaluation and include that in their decision making about what programs they're going to recommend to the broader board. Is that what you're saying?
And I'd like some discussion from the broader board with the staff about the evaluations. So I don't mean to get off task, but I just, as I look and think about my role on the board, I don't have the deep knowledge that the staff have. So I do rely on the staff. We all do rely on the staff, and they're very good at providing us with information. But sometimes we need to ask staff, could you go back and show us what's been going on over a five-year period? Or we've been funding, I'm just going to use it as an example, PLL since 2009. What do the outcomes look like over the 7 years that we've been funding it? What I've noticed in the board meetings is that we don't have time to ask those questions or build in the evaluation opportunities. And I'm not criticizing the board. I think that this board is very busy and we have lots that keep us busy. But I'm hoping that by having this retreat and talking about evaluation that we figure out, well, maybe in the months of April and May before the staff make their recommendations, we have some discussion about the outcomes from certain identified programs that the staff want to highlight for the time being. Or that we spend some time in the fall looking at what were the outcomes a year ago as we move into building priorities. So I was again a bit overwhelmed, and I'll stop. At the 10 priority or the 10 goals that are in our mission statement for the next 3 years. And I can't as a board member at this point, and I will rely on staff, say, of those 10 goals that run from page 6 to 12, which ones have higher priority than the others, given our funding level? So I just feel a need for more board discussion with staff support on why are these our priorities? What is the evaluation data behind setting those as our priorities? Are 10 priorities realistic? And we have these 10 for the next 3 years, potentially. I mean, they're proposed, they're not finalized.
Okay, go ahead.
Period.
I was just going to say, the only thing I would say is that these are the priorities for the three-year plan, which is a requirement of the statute. So
right.
I see this as a more of an administrative document, and then when we get together and do the priorities and the funding decision support every year in November, or going into November, that is really the one I see as the more important document in terms of helping us to make decisions about where funding, how we use our funding. That is the one that's more responsive to kind of immediate need. You know, for example, the whole discussion about the jail diversion, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. The people with mental health involved in the jail. I mean, I personally think that is our largest priority at this point.
And I'm just struggling with how do we fit it in as something of a new priority, and how does the evaluation process help us? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to link our planning and funding with the evaluation, and just trying to get a kind of a one-year overview of.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm being premature in asking that.
Well, what I would say is that we are currently funding things to deal with that population.
Right.
And that if we have a better evaluation, that will help us figure out whether what we're funding is effective and is doing the job. But the reality is that this problem of the jail diversion is so large, and that what we're doing now we know is just not enough, mm-hmm. and we're going to have to make some decisions to do more things. But I really think the document that you guys approve in November, is the key document, that this is more of an administrative discussion of what our overall, there's a lot of things going on, you're right, it is hard to get your head around.
I think there are some opportunities, because I know the staff does do quarterly evaluations of all of our funded agencies, so I think if the board was interested, we could have some discussions every quarter about how those are looking before we get to the funding priorities. If that was our decision, right, staff? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that. Well, thank you.
The other thing just to say about this is that one of the challenges in evaluation helping shape practice is that it often lags, right? So if you have a group right now that you have a one-year funding cycle, you have people right now who are in the midst of implementation. So, for example, there would be no data, right, that would probably be substantial enough to help with this problem that you're presenting. And so that's something, again, it's a structural problem, but it also raises a structural question about the timing of funding or the, whether or not you want to have some programmatic buildup. I mean, I'm not suggesting that. I'm brainstorming in the moment as well. But just to say that that's a practical problem with what you're talking about, and I'll make a note here about how to think about that in the planning. So you might not always have exactly the information you want, especially not in the short term.
Right.
That would help with that problem. It doesn't mean we can't think in a longer term way about that, especially when you've identified a community problem like the jail diversion issue. And then you can start as a board saying, we want to track certain things at the level of the community. So it's not even just programmatic, to see, is our investment making a difference in what we understand about the scope of the problem? And that's not just a programmatic question, because you're putting a collection of resources toward that. But you probably won't know in the perfect timing in November, yeah. because you'll have just started something, right? So just to throw that in there.
I think part of it's the issue of ensuring that we have time for those discussions and that we're not just, focused mm-hmm. on funding decisions. And again, I've been on the board for 2 years, so I'm just now at a point where I'm beginning to have some history and some breadth. And
maybe we need an extra meeting somewhere in that April area.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Peter, that's just a matter of how you guys do the process. It seems to me that the notion of how you prioritize the priorities is not just something that you and Lynn and Mark do. Part of that is related to what proposals you actually get. For instance, we've been trying to deal for several years now with the whole wellness thing, and we just don't get the proposals other than Nancy's. So if that's one of our major priorities, those aren't the proposals that are coming in. So some of this is talking about what do we receive once we get a proposal, we're not going to fund something that's not in one of these priorities. But everything we get, it doesn't fit our ranking of what those priorities might be.
So, well, here's the thing,
maybe
Tom,
you can talk about.
If we don't get what we want, that's when you do an RFP. And we have the capacity to do an RFP if we need to, a request for proposals, as we did, you know. So again, you know, if we think that the big priority is jail diversion, and we don't get a proposal that addresses what the community thinks is needed, then we can say we're not going to fund anything, and we're going to do an RFP, and these are the specifications of what we're going to ask for. So we're not really, you know, subject just to what we receive.
Just a little diversion. Susan, I think I heard you say that you wish that we, as a board, would spend a little more time evaluating with the providers. And I think that's a really good idea, but I think it's also very difficult to do. The staff is in touch with them all the time. And as you said, we do count on them. But for us to do the kind of work with the providers that I think you were implying, I might have been mistaken. While it's a good idea, it's tough to do. We tried to do that for a number of years, and it didn't work out. We didn't do it very well, or it was not helpful.
I don't think I was implying that we would do it in depth, because the staff does that, but that we would have, for instance, the whole issue with the SAMHSA project, making sure that there, and I think our board did have enough information on the SAMHSA project, on the access project, about its outcomes. But when we have something that is high stakes, ensuring that the staff provide us with the evaluations, and that if there's a big discussion about employment first, that the groups that are providing employment first be available for questions, mm-hmm. to inform us.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea.
And it wouldn't be everything. We'd have to choose, you know, mm-hmm. which are the issues we want to focus on this year. We're still going to be maintaining a lot of work. We can't focus on all 27 projects. Staff can, thank God, but we're only here maybe 30 hours a year.
But I think the staff is focusing on the evaluation piece. We just need to talk about it.
With the staff.
Right.
Mark has a dead microphone, but something.
Okay.
You want this one, Mark?
Oh, well, I just don't have the magic touch.
The expert.
We do get quarterly reports from agencies. There was a point in time where we had providers come in and on a regular basis present to the board an overview. As part of their application process, we asked them to kind of summarize what they have accomplished through the program. We do include kind of information about that in our program summaries. And in addition to the quarterly reports, several years ago, we started asking the agencies to provide a performance outcome report, an annual kind of at the end of the year, after the program's closed. It's due the end of August. In addition to their fourth quarter reports, they're asked to provide a performance outcome report that summarizes their activity for the year. Last year, at the October board meeting, copies of those in their entirety were provided to the board. So similar to a very large packet you receive in April related to program summaries, you had from each agency and the documents themselves reflect the capacity of the agency to compile and present this information, but you had that information before you. So now, it was an awful lot of information. As I recall, we had some other issues come up at that particular meeting. But in addition to that, there was also the zip code and demographic data that quantified an agency's level of service, not at the program level, but as an agency as a whole. So you had that information. I think if you were wanting to have a point in time in which the board had access to that information, it would be at the October meeting. Now, Lynn does something similar. She actually provides a summary for the DD board. We could certainly do something similar in the future for the mental health board and have that be a topic for the October meeting. We do have a meeting schedule that you're referring to. I think for the October meeting, it typically is the release of the draft criteria. And then followed in November with the decision memo on that. But that's a point in time in which the agencies have provided the board with their outcome reports. It's typically something that we review internally. It's something that may be discussed during the monitoring visits with them. But I think in terms of a point in time, that is likely the best point in time at which to look at the question of evaluation, because the information will be fresh coming in. We will have year-end data that we can tabulate for the year as a whole in terms of how many people have been served, and then also provide either in its entirety or a summary of what they're providing in terms of an annual performance outcome report. This work is intended to strengthen that report that they provide to us. Yes, yes, yeah.
So I have a question. I'm wondering, in what way or ways do we look at what the providers are doing, how well that in the aggregate that aligns with our three-year plan and the one-year objectives? I read them and I think, hot dog, this is really good stuff. Yes, we should be doing all this. And it's a lot. It's a lot. So, you know, I'd love it if we found that providers, or that we matched what the providers are doing, or the other way around.
The three-year plan, as Peter said, it's an administrative document. Yeah. It's intended as a guide in terms of direction for the board in terms of where we think things are headed and what our priorities are as a board. It's broad. It's intended to provide some flexibility. The first goal in that plan this year is on the broader service continuum that reflects an ongoing commitment to a breadth of services that range from, from birth through death, essentially, in that that reflects a commitment that we have to make an investment into a wide range of services. But also within that plan are some more focused goals related specifically to multi-system involved youth and families in terms of being sure that they continue to be supported, and then also jail diversion or mental health and criminal justice. And so we have in the plan a broader initial goal related to sustaining an existing commitment to a broad range of services, but also as a, as another priority, our investment in what is essentially the sustainability plan for Access Initiative. It's not framed that way, but that's the intent of that, that particular goal. And then also with mental, the criminal justice issue, be it for adults or juveniles. And that, I believe, will be reflected in our priorities. And our, we've typically, and then we also have a commitment to intellectual disabilities and developmental disabilities. Those three areas, the sustainability plan, criminal justice, mental health, and IDDD, are likely to reflect the highest priorities of in terms of criteria. But that doesn't mean, at least this is in, from my perspective, that we don't also have an obligation to continue to have investments in early childhood services, in mental health treatment for youth and adults, and for the elderly. But our investment there isn't necessarily, it's not as high a priority or high visibility as the issues related to criminal justice or multi-involved, multi-systemic involved youth and families.
So there's a policy issue that arises around that, and it's around Ann's point about, I guess I would think of it as, do we get added value from what we provide? And that's a seems to me that's a policy question that you just addressed. That is, do we get added value from spreading the money around in small amounts to things that we don't have a huge impact on because we have some concern about them? Or should we concentrate our efforts more in a more, a few more focal areas? That's not an automatic, it's a policy that we could discuss. It seems to me that this conversation now has blended the first part of the agenda about evaluation with the second part, and I don't think that's necessarily bad, but it makes me wonder, as I was listening to what we're saying, in some ways, this do we think this board could benefit from evaluation of what we do? Because, as soon as you raised the questions that you raised, Susan, it what lit up for me was, I always have trouble figuring out exactly where the lines are between a board and staff. Between board, abstractly, I understand boards are supposed to set policies and staff are supposed to carry them out. And yet, many of us will have questions at a level of detail and a level of concern that will feel frustrated if we're not in the sort of, day-to-day engagement. Mm-hmm. And for me, the conclusion, I struggled with some of the same questions that you raised, especially in the first year that I was here, just trying to figure out, what was I supposed to know so that I could actually, when I voted for something, feel a good conscience about how I was voting. And I came to conclude that it's important that the board tell the staff what our priorities are, what we care about, what we want them to do. That's our job. And then it's also important for us to know, to decide whether or not we trust the staff when they tell us things. So there are many occasions in which we get, at least I read, of something that the staff has written that I'm supposed to vote on, and I have to decide, do I believe them or not? And if I don't believe them, then I think we better do something about changing the way we communicate to staff or changing our staff. So at some point, we have to be willing to trust the staff to carry out our intentions, and we have to say that we do. That doesn't mean we have to just do what they want. It means we have to tell them what we want them to do. But at some point, we have to accept, we have to be trusting in that relationship. So finding that balance between us being responsible policymakers and trusting our staff to carry out the work
you know, I mean, I personally have conclusions about how the staff works, you know, and which, I mean, I think I could say I don't have any problem. I feel the staff do a tremendous amount of work. I don't know how they accomplish as much as they do, frankly, given the number of things that they're asked to do. And so I'm not suggesting that we don't get information. I'm just suggesting at some point in this process, board members have to trust the staff to be giving them good information. And if this evaluation can help the staff give us better information, then to me, that's a really good use of evaluation. So that's a long sort of reflection on what's been said.
But I think what Susan is saying is we need to have that evaluation and that information shared more with the board.
So here's my concern about this. Now, and again, I'm certainly in favor of that myself. There's the abstract desire and there's the realities of time. We have a board meeting once a month for less than 2 hours often. Well, it could be longer. Are we willing to have long board meetings? If you want to go to a meeting from 4:30 to 6 and say the meeting is now over, there's no way we could possibly do that.
That's right.
If the information is valuable to the board, I'd be willing to stay longer.
I mean, I think so. That's, to me, a question of board policies and maybe self-evaluation as to how much time and energy and investment board members are willing to make.
Well, Julian, I'm willing to bet that there would never be enough time. I've sat on a board that meant far longer than this board even could imagine meeting. And the same issues continued. So the idea that, we pay a group of people to do that stuff is, yeah, you have to assume that they're doing, maybe our job is to build an environment by which they can do the job that we want done. But I'm willing to bet that if we met every day, all day, we would still have the same concerns about knowing what the staff is doing. So there's that gray area. It has to be, you have to say, we got the right people on the staff, and they're providing us with the stuff that we think that we need. And I think in separating the board from the staff, there is that part where you just have to say, they're doing the job.
Yeah, well, that was really my point, that we have to be able to trust them. But I also do think that it's reasonable to say the same issues that we think apply to to agencies about their self-evaluation, to the extent that we feel like collaborators with our staff, we'll trust them more. And to the extent that we feel like, well, we don't have any time to talk to them about what we expect them to do or about a particular program that's on our mind, we'll feel less confident. And so I think we have to have some sort of way to find a process that enables, I would like to see every board member feel confident that all the questions that they have and all the things they want to communicate to the staff are communicated. They don't all have to be done in this meeting either. I mean, there's no reason why individual board members can't come visit the staff or call the staff up and talk to them. And so, I mean, I just think it's too much of a burden. I mean, as I said, I think we need longer time sometimes to discuss issues, but I don't think it's possible to do it in those meetings. So I think it's I would say it should be a responsibility of board members who want to have a closer look to make the time and effort to have the closer look. You don't have to do it in this meeting, right? I mean, I've come to the
Let's imagine that you created that space. Let's imagine that you created that space, the opportunity to chew that kind of information over together. What can we ask what kinds of information you feel like you want more of? What do you want to know now about what's happening with your money or with the programs you're funding? Or I think that having that some of that conversation now would be helpful to us and to thinking about how to build capacity to get it.
Well, the one thing that I think the agency should be looking at is how well they're serving the entire community and the CLC issues that we said we would address, and are they disaggregating their services by, you know, gender, ethnicity, other than zip codes? Because where I live and where I interact with people, I always get this constant kind of pushback, you know, that the agencies are not responsive to people of color in this community. So I think that we need to have the agencies really talk in explicit terms about how well they are working to address that particular perception.
So if that's a board priority, to know questions of how well are the programs that we fund responsive to the minority communities?
We say it is. It's in our three-year plan.
Then we should be very explicit,
yeah,
about getting that information, looking at it, communicating back about what we think about it. And sometimes creates, but you have to realize there'll be controversy. I mean, just
we're a
public body, and it's very, everything we say about anything like that creates controversy. So, I mean, it's fine, but just that's reality.
Okay. Can I just make a brief comment? I do trust the staff. I do call the staff. I do email the staff. I've met with the staff. I've asked for information. They've been wonderful. So I don't think it's do we trust the staff issue, or that do some board members not trust the staff issue, nor do I think it is that it's an issue of we could meet until the cows come home. I think that sometimes we could meet a little bit longer, and we could have a more focused discussion on some evaluations. And I'm not recommending that we expand all of our meetings to 3 or 4 hours, but that there are certain times of the year where we need more time to understand what we're doing, to be able to have a well-developed, considered vote, that we at least understand each other's agreements and disagreements on.
Good. I couldn't agree good more.
And I think
there's another.
Excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think all another right thing that we need to evaluate is, do the agencies have the technology infrastructure to deliver what it is that we're looking for? I think, you know, they need to raise expectations in that area, so they should be capable of looking at any of the objectives that we have on the table for them.
There's another item that I'd like to just put out. Nicole mentioned that It's important that what we do reflect local priorities. And I agree with that. But figuring out what those local priorities are cannot be an easy thing to do. But I still think we ought to put our minds at times to doing exactly that, or at least to finding out how to do it. I don't know. Do you know? Does anybody know?
Some of them just hit us right in the face, like that jail diversion thing. I mean, it just comes right at you. I mean,
well, yeah, it does, doesn't it?
See, I think that the jail, mental health problems in the jail is a good example, which I'm proud of the way this staff and board reacted to an issue that was percolating and coming up for some time, and we changed. When we became aware of the problem, that there was a mental health issue in the jails, we invited Urbana police officer to come and talk about the problems that the police have with making decisions about sending people to jail. What I found was that instantly, the majority of the board felt that this was appropriate for us to do enough to change our priorities. And Peter and Mark and Lynn responded to that. And they actually renegotiated some contracts in order to meet that. It was a very instantaneous, amazingly rapid. Now, am I completely satisfied with where it's at and what it's done? No. I got some complaints about it. I can't remember exactly what Mark's question was, but I was thinking of it.
there was an example of something I wanted to know more about. I think that's what you were asking. And so what I'm saying is this is a process, right?
Sure.
And I think that the needs do come to us fairly obviously at various moments.
I'm thinking, Julian, that it'd be good if we could... We want to identify needs before they hit us in the face, if possible. That's really all I'm saying.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, too. And I think that, you know, I'm totally flabbergasted by the reaction of some portion of the political community to the Access Initiative.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what that was. It was the development. It just amazes me that there was an absolute ecstatic excitement and welcome to that, because it, first of all, it brought in a bunch of money that wasn't local money and used it for local things. And yes, it was time limited, but it mattered. It helped, it engaged things here. It created other things here. And it dealt with some of the questions that Dolores just raised. And those may be our priorities. But we're in an odd environment in that regard, because we're a public body, and so whatever we do has inherent political meaning, apparently, even though to us it often is not political. It has to do with human services. But I think we're quite capable of responding, anticipating, and responding. And I see the same thing going on with independent living. And the whole issue of, you know, purchasing housing to make it more likely in this community, and there's a tension. I guess this is the place to talk about all those things, the tensions between traditional services and new progressive services that are in line with where a lot of people in developmental disabilities think is the future. Well, there's a real tension there, and it makes parents reasonably nervous. And so we have to find ongoing balance between anticipating and meeting needs and so on. It's an interesting job, but it's not necessarily going to be without controversy. And we're not going to make everybody happy.
Yeah. I think what I just realized is that what frustrates me about this stuff, and goes back to Deb's question, do you know how to set priorities, is the lack of history of how this board has functioned. Maybe we should have had some of that historical before we even started. But when I got on the board, the board had just brought down a consultant from Chicago named Charles Bell. And they had also just had a long involvement with how to create a system of care. Like, today isn't the first day of the mental health board. So what we're doing now didn't just happen. It's related to a whole series of things. So, like, wherever our priorities might come from, for me, they start at the point where we were trying to put together a system of care, and we brought down Bill to talk about it. He was just another of a consultant to do that.
Carl Bell, by the way.
Yeah, what is it?
Carl.
Carl Bell. And when Peter did the PLL, that was a result of a long discussion. So it didn't just drop on us and we say, hey, this seems to be a nice thing that we should do. So my frustration here is the absence of people knowing the history of how this stuff has happened. And those priorities that we now might have, maybe they weren't the same as they were 6 or 7 years ago, but they changed for a particular reason. And those reasons can be substantiated. Is that the right way to set priorities? I don't know, but it does reflect some of the priorities of this community. When I first came here 30, 40 years ago, which is Julian's fault, by the way, that we ran a program for teenage mothers to take care for daycare. They could leave their children in daycare. That was the first of that program in the whole country. No, nobody else was doing that. After 2 years, the community mental health center came and they took one of our directors to do a program with children. That was the first time that they did something with children. So the notion of working with access, that has a long history. That didn't just happen because we got an access grant. Mental health in this community has been trying to deal with children and child development for at least 30 years that I know of. So at some point, I'd like for us to know what's the history of where we are. We didn't just wake up and get here. The same with this evaluation. We didn't just wake up and say to Mark and Nicole, come and show us how to do evaluation. We've been working with these guys for a decade trying to figure out how do you do this. And so for me, it's a little frustrating to act like there's no foundation. There's no background. It's just now.
Well, don't you think when you choose a board, a volunteer board, people should do their homework and take an interest in the board and see what's going on? Right. I know, but before you decide to get on a board, right.
You know, I don't have the sense that we don't know what we're doing. I have the sense that we don't always know why we're doing what we're doing and what we're going to do in the future. And If you want to add board members over time and have a vibrant board where you have some turnover and some new members who might bring in new questions and energy, then yes, an orientation would be great. But also, you know, it's fairly common practice to do a five-year review of what have we been funding over the last 5 years? Does it still make sense to fund in the same way? Should we fund childcare right now because there's a child care assistance program disaster in the state? Or have we gone beyond funding childcare? We're doing other things. I'm glad we're having this retreat that we're talking about evaluation, because I think that for those of us who haven't been on the board 10 years or for that time period, and there will be more of us that come and go because boards are supposed to have some level of turnover, we need to have built into our schedule and our time a way of talking about what's working, why is it working, maybe what's not working as much as we would like it to work, and what are some of the new issues that come in, which goes back to perhaps building more time into October or April for discussions. That's what I'm asking for. I'm not saying that I distrust the board, that I think that the board has no history, none of that. It's just how do we make reasonable, considered decisions based on evaluation that maybe goes back X number of years with staff reports and raise questions that staff might not think about. The staff are going to carry on these programs.
I'm going to stop the discussion just right now. It's 10 o'clock, and I think we could discuss this topic for a very long time. And we probably will, but we can't do it all at once.
Yes, but we want to be mindful of time, too. And we were about to make the same suggestion that we back out of this conversation. But we would like to continue it with each of you individually. So if we could, if there's interest in that, we would be happy to meet with you and to further pick your brains about what your personal interests are with respect to information that might Great. Be gathered via Wonderful. Evaluation.
Once yeah. again, thank you for coming.
Yeah, once again, showing your brilliance, that was exactly what I was going to ask if board members would agree to, because I think we need some evaluation help for our own processes, uh-huh. and you could help us do it, because you're outsiders into the board.
And it's a part of capacity building, right, to build right. all of our evaluation literacy and our ability to think about those questions, so it fits right in.
And we need okay. some coaching on when does a board come to the fork in the road when there needs to be some abandonment. You know, we have limited yeah. resources, so we can add on and add on. But at what point in the change process, should we abandon some of the projects and in order to pick up the new projects?
So you see what you've done this morning. I mean, stirred up a lot of very, very interesting and important issues and questions. So we all, I'm sure, appreciate your coming here. And for those...
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, okay. For those board members who are willing to meet with you, I think that too would be a very good idea, and we'll leave it to the staff to figure that out.
We'll be reaching out to you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. So, you can.
Yeah, I'd like to, we'll do that, and I'd like to actually, if I can still stay here, so I can
Oh, sure. Sure. Well, I'm going to suggest...
I would entertain a little short break. 5 minutes.
I'm just about to announce
Oh,
one.
Thank you, Madam President.
Holy cow. Oh, boy. She doesn't trust me to know when we need to break. I'm going to say 10 minutes, and then let's come back and move on with the program.
So the issue is, does the board trust me?